and the stewardess was instantly branded. Today, she's probably a vice president. The novelist Milan Kundera once reflected that flirting is the promise of sex with no guarantee. A successful brand, then, is the promise and guarantee of a mind-shattering experience each and every time. It's the email you always read because of who it's from. It's the employee who always gets the cool projects. To become a brand, you've got to become relentlessly focused on what you do that adds value. And I promise you can add value to whatever job you're doing now. Can you do what you do faster and more efficiently? If so, why not document what it would take to do so and offer it to your boss as something all employees might do? Do you initiate new projects on your own and in your own spare time? Do you search out ways to save or make your company more money? You can't do all that if you're solely concerned with minimizing risk, respecting the chain of command, and following your job description to the letter. There's no room for yes-men in this pursuit. Those with the gumption to make their work special will be the ones to establish a thriving brand. You can't do meaningful work that makes a difference unless you're devoted to learning, growing, and stretching your skills. If you want others to redefine what you do and who you are within organizational boundaries, then you have to be able to redefine yourself. That means going above and beyond what's called for. It means seeing your resume as a dynamic, changing document every year. It means using your contacts inside and outside your network to deliver each project you're assigned with inspired performance. Peters calls this the pursuit of wow in everything you do. There are a whole lot of roadmaps out there these days to self-incorporated wowness. But the maps often rely more on intuition than navigation. The key generally comes down to a few simple things. Shake things up. Find your value. Obsess on your image. Turn everything into an opportunity to build your brand. So how do you create an identity for a brilliant career? How do you become the swoosh of your company, of your network? Here are three steps to get you on the road to becoming the next Oprah Winfrey. Develop a personal branding message, PBM. A brand is nothing less than everything everyone thinks of when they see or hear your name. The best brands, like the most interesting people, have a distinct message. Your PBM comes from your content unique value proposition, as we discussed in the last chapter, and a process of self-evaluation. It involves finding out what's really in a name, your name. It calls for you to identify your uniqueness and how you can put that uniqueness to work. It's not a specific task so much as the cultivation of a mindset. What do you want people to think when they hear or read your name? What product or service can you best provide? Take your skills, combine them with your passions, and find out where in the market or within your own company they can best be applied. Your message is always an offshoot of your mission and your content. After you've sat down and figured out who you want to be, and you've written goals in some version of 90-day, 3-year, and 10-year increments, you can build a brand perception that supports all this. Your positioning message should include a list of words that you want people to use when referring to you. Writing those words down are a first big step in having others believe them. Ask your most trusted friends what words they would use to describe you, for good and for bad. Ask them what are the most important skills and attributes you bring to the table. When I was once hungry to become chief executive officer at a Fortune 500 company, my PBM read as follows. Keith Ferrazzi is defined as one of the most innovative and bottom-line-focused marketers and CEOs in the world. His string of dramatic firsts have followed every position he has held. His passion gives off a light that he carries wherever he goes. Package the brand. Most people's judgments and impressions are based on visuals. Everything other than the words you speak that communicates to others what you're about. For everyone in every field, let's be real, image counts. So whatever your look, take time to think it through. What is your appearance telegraphing to others? There is one general overarching caveat in this step. Stand out. Style matters. Whether you like it or not, clothing, letterheads, hairstyles, business cards, office space, and conversational style are noticed. Big time. The design of your brand is critical. Buy some new clothes. Take an honest look at how you present yourself. Ask others how they see you. How do you wish to be seen? These days, individuals are fortunate to have broad latitude in how they express themselves in hair, makeup, and dress. You don't need to put on a de facto uniform to fit in all but the most conservative of professions. But the bottom line is this, particularly when you're just starting out, you have to craft an appearance to the outside world that will enhance the impression you want to make. Everyone sees what you appear to be, observed Machiavelli. Few really know what you are. When I was younger, I used to wear bow ties. I felt that it was a signature that people would not quickly forget. And it worked. You were the guy who spoke at that conference last year wearing the bow tie. I'd hear over and over again. Over time, I was able to give up that signature as my message and delivery became my brand. And I didn't think the bow tie corresponded to my evolving image of someone on the cutting edge of ideas. We've already talked about fine-tuning your social media profiles. Why not create a personal website as well? A website is a terrific and cheap marketing tool for your brand, and a great way to force you to clearly articulate who you are. With a good-looking site, you look as polished and professional as any major corporation on the Internet. And with free site-building tools like Wix.com and About.me, you don't need to be a web developer to get there. This may sound trivial, but it's not. Little choices make big impressions. Broadcast your brand. You've got to become your own PR firm, as I'll talk about in the next chapter. Take on the projects no one wants at work. Never ask for more pay until after you've been doing the job successfully and become invaluable. Get on convention panels. Write articles for online publications and company newsletters. Send emails filled with creative ideas to your CEO. Design your own Me, Inc. brochure. The world is your stage. Your message is your play. The character you portray is your brand. Look the part. Live the part. Chapter 27. Broadcast your brand. Now you have your content and the beginnings of a brand. You're getting good, really good. That's how you've become an authority in your company and your existing network. But your job is not done. If the rest of the world isn't familiar with how good you are, you and your company are only gaining part of the benefit. The fact is, you've got to extend your reach and level of outside recognition. That's how you'll become an authority, not just in your company, but in your industry. It comes in part from visibility. I'm not suggesting you stand on your local street corner with a sign on a sandwich board exclaiming, "Put me on TV!" Though, come to think of it, well, let's hold off for now. I've got some suggestions on high-stakes self-promotion that will make your effort becoming known a little bit easier, sans the public embarrassment. And I'm no stranger to embarrassment. I've taken a few knocks to learn the right and wrong ways to let others know about what I do. You don't have to look far to see why increased visibility might be important for your career and for extending your network of colleagues and friends. Take, for example, self-promoting phenom Donald Trump. How many other real estate moguls do you know offhand? Right. I can't name anyone else either. Why is the Donald considered the ultimate deal-maker? Probably because he's called himself that a million times over in any number of articles and television interviews, and now a highly rated TV show. Because he has a book entitled The Art of the Deal. But his self-promotion is not just ego, though by how much I'm not quite sure. It makes plenty of business sense, too. His buzzworthy brand now has a value unto itself. Buildings with his name on it are more valuable and bring in higher rental fees. When the Donald went bankrupt, banks that would have otherwise foreclosed on any other struggling mogul gave Trump leeway, not only because they knew he was good at what he did, but because they knew his name alone would go a long way in helping him recover from his setbacks. Trump is a talented developer, but then so are a lot of other people. The difference? He promotes himself. The fact is that those people who are known beyond the walls of their own cubicle have a greater value. They find jobs more easily. They usually rise up the corporate ladder faster. Their networks begin to grow without much heavy lifting. I can hear the groans of discomfort already stirring. You may be thinking, I'm shy. I don't like to talk about myself. Isn't modesty a virtue? Well, I can assure you that if you hide your accomplishments, they'll remain hidden. If you don't promote yourself, however graciously, no one else will. Like it or not, your success is determined as much by how well others know your work as by the quality of your work. Luckily, there are hundreds of new channels and mediums for you to get the word out. So how do you promote brand you? Strategy 1. Pop the bubble. You'll often hear people call social media a virtual cocktail party. I would agree that similar rules apply, but add this. If social media is a party, I think we're hitting the moment when the fire marshal comes and breaks it all up because it's a mob scene. In such a moment, it's very difficult to show up and make any kind of successful entrance. You also have another problem, what author Eli Pariser calls the filter bubble. Social and search platforms use complicated, imperfect algorithms to filter stuff out, trying to make sure users see only what most interests them. If you want to burst through someone's invisible bubble and grab their attention, you need to create content that gets shared and preferably reshared and then shared some more. Pariser, the former executive director of MoveOn.org, decided to do something about this filter bubble problem. First, he wrote a book on it. Then he hooked up with the former managing editor of the satire site, The Onion, to create a media venture called Upworthy.com, a social native mission-driven media startup setting out to make important issues, read left-leaning political news, go as viral as a video of some guy jumping on his bed and then falling out the window. On its face, it sounds like a non-starter. Many people avoid politics on their social sites the way they avoid it around the Thanksgiving dinner table. But a year after launch, Upworthy's traffic was comparable to that of sites like People magazine and the Drudge Report. Upworthy not only made it to people's newsfeed, it also burst the mainstream media bubble with call-outs on The Rachel Maddow Show and ample coverage in places like the New York Times. Upworthy seems to have done the impossible. Let's take away a few rules that will help you do it, too. Go visual. Most of the Internet's early celebrities were bloggers. At the time, personality and a point of view were all it took to get your site noticed. These days, blogging is still a great way to communicate your ideas online and build loyalty and credibility. But long, text-heavy blog posts aren't necessarily the best content hook to draw new people in. On the link-sharing site Reddit, 90% of the links that make it to the front page, in other words, the most clicked, are images. Photos, infographics, animated GIFs, slide shares. These are much more likely to catch someone's eye and get passed on. Caring is sharing. Posts that get shared make an emotional impact in seconds, according to the online marketing experts at Moz.com. These guys have become like Eskimos and snow when it comes to fine slicing emotion to see what kind of reaction leads to shares. Their work builds on that of Wharton professor Jonah Berger, who conducted an exhaustive study of the most emailed links on the New York Times website and wrote a book about the results. Contagious, Why Things Catch On. He and the team at Moz came to similar conclusions. Although positive emotions are better overall than negative ones, most people like to be aroused. This includes positive emotions, awe, amusement, joy, but also some negative ones like anger, things that rile us up, fill us with vitriol. In short, caring is sharing. So ditch your milquetoast posts and say something that matters. Curation, not creation. Upworthy found that the best strategy for producing viral content was curation, not creation. They pull links that are already performing well in social media. They repackage them with irresistible headlines and use their easy-to-share page template, and it's like pouring lighter fluid on a flickering fire. But this also applies when you're creating content. Just like Gary Vaynerchuk, whom I mentioned earlier, pay attention to the conversation that's already in process. What words are people using? What are they talking about? Bring that awareness into what you create. When you're speaking their language, your posts will jump out like a McDonald's in Tokyo. Strategy 2. Manipulate the media. Every day you read or hear about companies in newspapers, magazines, on television, and on the web. Most of the time, the article or story is about celebrity CEOs and big companies. It's not because they're more deserving of the press than you or me. It's the result of well-planned and strategic public relations. Big companies have PR machines working for them to shape and control their image, though not always successfully. Smaller companies and individuals have to do it themselves. But by using some pluck and a strategy of your own, access to the media is not as difficult as you may think. Journalists do less sleuthing for their stories than you'd imagine. They get a majority of their stories from people who have sought them out, and not the other way around. And like everyone else in any profession, they tend to follow the herd. Which means once you get written about, other reporters will come calling. assigned you as a subject. They'll do a quick Google search, and presto. They'll find you are an already cited source and will seek you out to cite you again. One article creates visibility, which in turn will put you in front of other journalists, creating the possibility of more articles and visibility. A journalist's deadlines make magazine and newspaper work the art of the possible, not the perfect. The key is to view the exposure of your brand as a PR campaign. How are you going to get your message out there? How are you going to make sure that the message gets out the way you want it to get out? Sure, your network is a good start. Everyone you meet and everyone you talk to should know what you do, why you're doing it, and how you can do it for him or her. But why not broadcast that same message to 1,000 networks across the country? Now we're talking. As I mentioned before, when I became CEO of Yaya, it was a company with virtually no revenue and clearly no recognized market. We had visionary founders, Jeremy Milken and Seth Gerson. But we needed a market. There was, however, one company with a similar product. I'm going to call them Big Boy Software. They had created a software tool that facilitated the actual creation of high-end games. They, too, were trying to find their business model and generate revenue. But both of us were in a race to become the established brand in the new market we were creating. Soon after we defined the advergaming space, Big Boy saw how Yaya was picking up steam and generating operating revenue, selling games to big brands. They followed suit, positioning themselves as competitors to Yaya. The main difference between them and us was that they had way, way more money. They had raised a huge amount of capital that put our resources to shame. There is no need to go into the comparative details of who was a better company. I'm a little biased, of course. But the fact remains they had tons of resources and we did not. At all. So how did Yaya become the market leader? The answer is, we created buzz, that powerful, widespread phenomenon that can determine the future of individuals, companies, and movies alike. Buzz is the riddle every enterprising person is trying to solve. It's a grassroots word-of-mouth force that can turn a low-budget flick into a multi-million-dollar blockbuster. You feel its energy in internet chat rooms, at the gym, on the street, and all of it is stoked by a media hungry for the inside scoop. Buzz is marketing on steroids. Here's an example of how well it works. Remember Napster? One day it was a clever software idea hatched in some kid's dorm room, allowing users online to link up and share MP3 music files. 6 months later, it was a Silicon Valley startup, the source of a major lawsuit, playing bandwidth havoc with servers around the country. Even when it was shut down, the name had enough buzz to be bought for something like $50 million. Advertising or a life-empowering endorsement by Oprah had nothing to do with it. Napster was, well, cool. And as a result of buzz, it was very famous. As a marketer, over the years, I have developed an idea of how buzz is created. One way is to generate what I call catalytic moments. When you watch a big football game, have you noticed how the tide of a game will suddenly turn in favor of one team or the other? It starts with a huge play, and in many cases is followed by more key plays. Buzz is like that. It needs a situation, a pivotal moment, an inside scoop, a crazy giveaway, something that will get the crowd whispering. Unfortunately, Yaya was too young and poor for such a strategy. Another way is to report compelling news by leveraging the power of the media to get your brand sizzling. The Jesse Ventura for Governor of Minnesota campaign is a perfect example. Significantly outspent by two major competitors, Ventura gained valuable media exposure by persuading the media to report on things like his creative use of advertising and a G.I. Joe-like action figure. Similarly, I look for compelling stories that create buzz within the news media. That's where feeding the influentials comes into play. Influentials are what marketing wonks call those people who can ignite brand buzz. They are the small segment of the population that will adopt a cool product early on and infect everyone else with the bug. They are also the celebrities and experts whose word is gospel. It's imperative that you identify those people and get your brand in front of them. I mentioned the KPE agency before. They were just what I was looking for, an interactive marketing and technology consultancy on the cutting edge. KPE had taken an early interest in the new space we were creating. They were a recognized name among Fortune 1000 companies, known for spotting the newest trends. Happily, their head of strategy was Matt Ringle, whom I had gotten to know from our mutual interest in the nonprofit Save American Treasures, which is devoted to preserving objects and places of historical significance. I reached out to Matt and proposed that he lead an effort to write an article introducing this space to the market. I knew that a white paper, research documents that consulting companies put out on hot topics of the day, introducing us and the technology from an unbiased perspective, would be far more effective and lead to more credibility than anything we could do ourselves. I worked with Matt and his right hand, Jane Chen, for weeks on the paper, giving them examples from Yaya, getting clients to speak with them, introducing methodologies and insights that we had gained through our experience. I had gone to analysts before this who were interested in the space and were now willing to speak to Matt about what we were doing as well. I was giving KPE another opportunity to look cutting edge and take a leadership position in the space, while in return, just by dint of the access I was giving KPE, I bet that Yaya would be the primary example in the case study. Great things came from the article, including the new name for the space, which we called, thanks to the creativity of Jane Chen, Advergaming. The name alone had buzz. One lesson we learned from the experience is that your PR campaign has to be realistic. More often than not, you will have to start small. You'll be forced to focus on your local paper, high school and college newsletters, or industry trade journals, or perhaps just a white paper listed on some consulting company's website. The point is to light the fire. When the white paper was completed, it received amazing publicity. Thanks to KPE's PR engine, which, unlike us, they could afford. And we indeed came out as the instant leader of the space. As an interesting side note, I subsequently recruited both Matt and Jane into Yaya. I wanted the founders of Advergaming in my organization. It took less than a year for us to appear on the cover of Brand Week in the Marketplace section of the Wall Street Journal, in the Technology section of the New York Times, in a feature for Forbes. The list goes on. I was consistently on every panel with the competition. Generally, I was invited for free, while the boys paid for the opportunity. While money can certainly be a substitute for good PR, it's hard to have enough of it to offset the credibility one gets from just one article in Forbes or the New York Times. The competition, on the other hand, got little press and failed to create a distinct message. It all goes back to your content. Once you have it, you can begin to mold it in a way that will capture attention. You need to impart a new sense of urgency and make the message timely. Reporters continually ask, "But why is it important now?" If you can't answer that sufficiently, your article will wait. In Yaya's case, I highlighted how the games industry is the fastest-growing segment of the entertainment business, and how, surprisingly, no one had figured out how to tap into that growth for anything other than pure fun and leisure. That isn't always enough. I had written a piece for the Wall Street Journal's weekly column called The Manager's Journal. The editor liked the piece, but kept pushing it back so that he could publish other pieces that were timelier. So I began to rewrite the intros to my piece each week, to relate to something that was in the news at the time. In short order, the article finally saw the light of day. Once you light a fire and get the buzz going, you want to get your story in front of journalists. The misconception is that you have to work the press. But overeager PR professionals who don't know the meaning of no are working reporters hourly. Journalists get fed up with people who are nitwits and pitch articles without substance. The media is like any other business. They have a job to do. If you can help them do their job better or easier, they're going to love you. You have to start today building relationships with the media before you have a story you'd like them to write. Send them information. Meet them for coffee. Call regularly to stay in touch. Give them inside scoops on your industry. Establish yourself as a willing and accessible source of information, and offer to be interviewed for print, radio, or TV. Never say, no comment. To illustrate, I remember the first time I, as the newly minted project leader of Deloitte's re-engineering efforts, sat with one of Fortune's top journalists, Tom Stewart. My PR firm introduced Tom and me, and I came ready to impress. I had read every piece he had written in the last 5 years. I playfully jibed him about obscure predictions he had made years ago in other articles, and was prepared to thoughtfully discuss his most recent column. I wanted to be as useful as possible, giving him access to trends, ideas, and all the contacts at my disposal. I did the same thing for other journalists at other major newspapers and magazines. Tom and I had a blast. Tom's energy and intellectual curiosity was contagious. I suppose I had something to offer him as well, because he readily took my next lunch offer, and the next after that. It was more than just mutual admiration. I was prepared to act, sound, and feel like an expert. When I didn't know something, I was sure to pass him on to the person who did. If you are constantly apologizing with, "Well, I am not the expert," people will believe you and wonder why you wasted their time. I never did ask Tom for anything in particular. We'd meet a few times a year, and I'd try to be as helpful as possible. Sure, I remember the first time I saw one of my ideas in his column months after we had discussed it, and lo and behold, a competitor firm was quoted rather than Deloitte. I went through the roof. My instinct was to call him immediately and express my unhappiness. But instead, I held back and simply invited him for another lunch. Is such a thing too time-consuming? Not if you're convinced it behooves your company's efforts, and if you enjoy the interaction. When I was at Deloitte and would show up on TV, I was Deloitte. When I was in Forbes, it was the company that reaped the benefits in business development. Over time, the hours you put in developing relationships with journalists will pay off, as it did for me with Tom, both personally and professionally. Deloitte's name eventually started to pop up with increasing frequency in the pages of Fortune, because our stories were being heard by someone who could retell them. I never asked Tom for an article, but giving him good ideas in our lunches certainly didn't hurt. Later, Tom became the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Business Review. Remember, though, you can't force-feed or pressure a good journalist. Any attempt to do so will surely end your professional relationship. The best journalists are almost always also the most ethical. In traversing the media landscape, be aware that there are also some landmines. Sometimes what the media want to write and the story you think they should write are very different things. I learned this the hard way. One day I got a call from the well-known reporter Hal Lancaster, who was writing a column about managing one's career for the Wall Street Journal. The story appeared Tuesday, November 19th, 1996. I know the exact date because I had the article framed, so I would never forget the lesson I learned. When Hal called, I was ecstatic. He was a famous reporter from a prestigious newspaper, asking about what I did. I was a relative kid at Deloitte. Well, that wasn't exactly the slant of the story, but my excitement got the best of me. Hal said he was doing a piece on the changing nature of work. He had a hypothesis that the end of the re-engineering movement was having a major impact on those who had led re-engineering projects and those who had been affected by the projects. Rather than listen more closely to this angle, I tried to impress upon him what I thought the real story was about. Big mistake. If a reporter calls you, states his story and the angle he's taking, you can be sure you'll be used as an example to buttress his angle. Rare is the occasion that a journalist will hear you out and say, "Oh my God, you're right. I'm really going about it all wrong." Rarely. I meant never. But back then, I thought I'd set Hal straight. He, however, ended up straightening me out. I took a lot of time with Hal explaining how I had been on the normal partner track leading Deloitte's re-engineering effort. But now that the trend was ending, I was transitioning into an exciting special project involving marketing. "I'm going to change the way traditional consulting companies market themselves." He pushed past my excitement. "Do you feel displaced in the post-re-engineering world?" he wanted to know. "Sure," I conceded. "There was some change involved, but certainly nothing traumatic." He wanted me to say I felt aimless. But my new gig excited me. I considered it a huge step up. The day the story appeared, I ran to the newsstand to get the paper. There, blaring out for everyone to see, was the heading, "A demotion does not have to mean the end of a fulfilling career." Right above the fold, in big, bold letters, was my name. "Mr. Ferrazzi says the change was difficult, but he has embraced the assignment as an opportunity." He was implying I was demoted. I got slammed. Oh, and the ribbing I got from my boss, Pat Licato. "So I hear you were demoted, and no one reports to you. That's terrific. It will save us tons on HR costs, starting with that raise of yours." Be careful. Listen to the reporter when he or she says, "I'm doing a story about displaced workers." No matter what you say, that's the story he'll write. Now that you know a little more about the lay of the land, it's time to get yourself buzzing. Here's an action plan for creating a PR strategy for brand you. You are your own best PR representative. You must manage your own media. Public relations companies are facilitators and act as leverage. I've been represented for years. The best ones can be strategic partners, but ultimately, the press always wants to talk to the big guy. You, not a PR rep. Most of the biggest articles about me came from my own contacts. Yes, a PR firm can help you generate those contacts, but early in your career, you won't need them, and you probably won't be able to afford them. Who better than you to tell your story with credibility and passion? Start making calls to the reporters who cover your industry. Have lunch with them. If something timely occurs around your content, send a press release. There's no secret behind press releases. They're nothing more than two or three paragraphs describing what's memorable about your story. It is that easy. Remember, media folks are just plain fun. They tend to be interesting and smart, and they're paid to be up to speed on everything that is going on in the world. and they need you as much as you need them. They may not need your exact story at the exact time you want, but with a little stick-to-itiveness, they'll come around. Know the media landscape. Nothing infuriates reporters and editors more, I'm told, than to get a pitch from someone who clearly has no idea what their publication is about or who their audience is. Remember, media is a business, and the companies who are in the media are looking for ratings or to sell more issues. The only way they can do that well is by serving their specific audience. Listen, I'm a devoted reader of this magazine, I'll tell editors while mentioning a few recent articles I've enjoyed. I've got a story for you that I know your audience will be interested in, as I've been thinking about it for a long time. That's not a line, either. Before I call journalists, I'll spend time reading their articles, figuring out what they cover, and what kinds of stories their publications like to run. Work the angles. There are no new stories, it has been said, only old stories told in new ways. To make your pitch sound fresh and original, find an innovative slant. What's your slant? Anything that screams now. Let's say you're opening a pet store to a magazine devoted to entrepreneurs. Perhaps you play up how your store is one recent example of the entrepreneurial boom in the opening of local retail stores. Suggest why this is happening and what the magazine's readers could learn. Selling it to your local newspaper is easy. What caused you to switch careers? What is particular to your situation that highlights something going on within your community? And don't forget catalytic moments. Maybe you sell a rare animal no one else does. Or maybe you plan on giving away puppies to orphans. That's something worth covering to a local or neighborhood newspaper. Get the word out. Think small. Are you Bill Gates? No. Maybe you've developed the antidote for the common cold. No again. Well, the New York Times probably isn't knocking on your door quite yet. Go local first. Start a database of newspapers and magazines in your area that might be interested in your content. Try college papers, the neighborhood newspaper, or the free industry digital newsletter you find in your inbox. You'll get the fire started and learn how to deal with reporters in the process. Make a reporter happy. They're a rushed, impatient, always stressed bunch of overachievers. Work at their pace and be available whenever they call on you. Never blow off an interview and try to facilitate the contacts they'll need to produce a good story. Master the art of the soundbite. Tell me why I should write about you in 10 seconds or less. If it takes more than 10 seconds to pitch your content, a television producer will assume you won't be able to get your point of view across to an impatient audience. And a reporter might try to hustle you off the phone. Learn to be brief in both your written and phone pitches. Brevity is cherished in the media. Look at the evolution of the modern soundbite. Some 30 years ago, a presidential nominee was allowed an average soundbite of 42 seconds. Today, it's somewhere under 7 seconds. If the president is only getting a few seconds, how much time do you think you'll get? Think in terms of talking points. Pick the 3 most interesting points about your story and make them fast, make them colorful, and make them catchy. Don't be annoying. There's a fine line between marketing yourself properly and becoming annoying. If a pitch of mine gets rejected, I'll ask what else it needs to make it publishable. Sometimes it will never be right in the editor's eyes, but other times you can answer a few more questions or dig deeper and repitch the story. It is okay to be aggressive, but mind the signals and back off when it's time. It's all on the record. Be cautious. What you say can hurt you. And even if you're not quoted or you say something off the record, a reporter will use your words to color the slant of the article. I'm not advocating being tight-lipped. That's what corporate communications directors get paid for. And I don't know anyone in the press who likes them. Just remember, all press is not good press, even if they spell your name right. Trumpet the message, not the messenger. There was a time when I was less aware of the difference between reputation and notoriety. Boy, there is a big difference. Early on in my career, I paid too much attention to getting attention. I was building a brand, all right, but as I look back, it just wasn't the brand I wanted for myself. All your efforts at publicity, promotion, and branding need to feed into your mission. If they're only feeding into your ego, you'll find yourself with a reputation you hadn't bargained for that could hold you back for the rest of your life. I was lucky. Looking back, I merely wasted a lot of time. Treat journalists as you would any other member of your network or community of friends. As in any interview, your primary objective when you meet with a member of the press is to get the person across from you to like you. The reporter is human, at least most are, and your empathy for his or her hard work will go a long way. Even when I feel like a piece did not do me justice, I thank the writer for his hard work. I'll send a short thank you email no matter the size of the publication. Journalists, by the nature of their profession, are natural networkers. Couple that with a media community that's not all that large, and you'll understand why you want these guys on your side. Be a name dropper. Connecting your story with a known entity, be it a politician, celebrity, or famous business person, acts as a de facto slant. Bottom line, the media wants recognizable faces in their pages. If your story will give them access to someone they otherwise haven't been able to get, they'll make concessions, or sometimes you can link a celebrity to your story without really knowing the person. Leave it to the journalist to track down the star. You've done your job by giving them reason to seek her out. You've got to market the marketing. Once you've put in all that hard work and landed a nice article, it's no time to be modest. Send the article around. Share it through social media. Give it to your alumni magazine. Update your class notes. Use the article to get even more press coverage. I'll attach a recent article about me to an email and in the subject line write, "Here's another one of Farazi's shameless attempts at self-promotion." Most people get a kick out of it, and it keeps you on everyone's radar. There's no limit to the ways you can go about enhancing your profile. There are literally thousands of different ways to get recognition for your expertise. Try moonlighting. See if you have the time to take on freelance projects that bring you in touch with a whole new group of people. Or, within your own company, take on an extra project that might showcase your new skills. Teach a class or give a workshop in your own company. Sign up to be on panel discussions at a conference. More important, remember that your circle of friends, colleagues, clients, and customers is the most powerful vehicle you've got to get the word out about what you do. What they say about you will ultimately determine the value of your brand. Chapter 28. Getting Close to Power. Donald Trump said, "As long as you're going to think anyway, think big." Newt Gingrich, the famous Republican politician and all-about Washington gadfly, is known to tell a story about a lion and a field mouse. A lion, he says, can use his prodigious hunting skills to capture a field mouse with relative ease, anytime he wants. But at the end of the day, no matter how many mice he's ensnared, he'll still be starving. The moral of the story? Sometimes, despite the risk and work involved, it's worth our time to go for the antelope. Are you only connecting with field mice? If you are, start turning your attention to reaching out to the sort of important people who can make a difference in your life and the lives of others. The kind of people who can make you and your network sparkle. The conscious pursuit of people with power and celebrity has a bad rap. We're taught to see it as an expression of vanity and superficiality. We regard it as a cheap and easy means of getting ahead. As a result, instead of acting on our impulses, we repress them. We buy celebrity magazines like People, Us Weekly, or, in the case of business folks, Fortune, to peer safely from a distance into a world we're so obviously hungry to know more about. I, on the other hand, think there's absolutely nothing wrong with pursuing this world more directly. Seeking the influence of powerful people in our lives is not crass or misguided. It can be enormously helpful. Again, no one does it alone. Whatever our goal or mission, we need the help of lots of others. Why is it that we're so taken with the lives of big achievers? If we measure our accomplishments against the accomplishments of others, it stands to reason that the more accomplished the people we associate with, the greater our aspirations become. People who fit our conventional notions of fame and celebrity often have qualities or skills that we admire. Many of these people have achieved great things through risk, passion, focus, hard work, and positive attitudes. And so many of them have overcome so much. Of course, celebrity can mean all sorts of things to all sorts of people. I define celebrity as public recognition by a large share of a certain group. In other words, fame is a matter of context. In college, public recognition is given to tenured professors or well-known deans. In a small Midwestern town, the celebrities may be a politician, successful entrepreneur, or outspoken long-time resident. These people have a disproportionate degree of influence over the group they inhabit. That's why it has become popular to use celebrities as spokespersons for major brands. They increase awareness, create positive feelings around a company, and play an important role in convincing consumers of a product's attractiveness. Local mini-celebrities within your own group can do the same for your brand. That's what social scientists call power by association. It's the power that arises from being identified with influential people. You can see this phenomenon at work everywhere. Power that arises from internal associations, for example, can include personal assistants and gatekeepers who may not be very high on the ladder in terms of company hierarchy, but who are powerful simply because of their proximity and access to the chief executive officer. External associations, such as powerful politicians, influential news reporters, mass media personalities, and so on, also help to enhance one's profile inside and outside an organization. That's why a smart startup company, for example, will seek to populate its board of directors with recognized business personalities who can impart credibility to a new business. Certainly, having the ear of influential celebrities or journalists can mean more favorable coverage of you and your company or an unprecedented amount of coverage for your charity. Fame breeds fame. The fact is, all my prowess for reaching out to other people would be far less effective if a few of those people in my Rolodex weren't well-known names. The hard truth is that the ones who get ahead are usually those who know how to make highly placed people feel good about having them around. Plus, they add a little magic. Real or imagined, these people have that X factor that can magnify a moment and turn a prosaic dinner party into something magnificent. Problem is, while we're excited by the idea of meeting celebrities, they are often not all that eager to meet us. So how can we get close to them? There are no easy answers. But if you pursue these people in a sincere manner with good intentions, you're not being manipulative. And if you are emboldened by a mission and you've put in time and hard work to establish a web of people that count on you, then the time will come when your growing influence will put you in a place where you'll be face to face with someone who can convey a lot of sparkle to your next dinner party. You'll get close to power simply by virtue of reaching out and following the advice I have offered in this book. When this does inevitably occur for you, there are a few things to keep in mind that I've learned through the years. While I'm aware of the impact a recognized persona can have on one's network, and I'm certainly not shy about putting myself in a place where meeting such people can occur, too much fuss and adoration will kill your efforts before they begin. Folks are folks. This came into play years ago when I was at the Vanity Fair party at the old Russian embassy following the White House press corps dinner. When I was standing in line for cocktails, the man beside me seemed awfully familiar. At first, I thought he was a politician. Then I placed his face as someone who was involved in politics, but behind the scenes in some manner, one of the president's key advisors. I was right. Sort of. The man was Richard Schiff, the actor who played the communications advisor to the fictional president, played by Martin Sheen, in The West Wing. Out of context, I'm terrible with recognizing TV stars. Just as casually as if he were someone I didn't know at all, I introduced myself. He paused slightly, as celebrities are apt to do before engaging with someone they don't know, and politely said hello without introducing himself. "And you are?" I asked. When he realized I didn't know who he was immediately, he opened up. We ultimately exchanged emails and stayed in touch. I found that trust is the essential element of mixing with powerful and famous people. Trust that you'll be discreet, trust that you have no ulterior motives behind your approach, trust that you'll deal with them as people and not as stars. And basically trust that you feel like a peer who deserves to be engaged as such. The first few moments of an encounter are the litmus test for such a person to size up whether he or she can trust you in these ways or not. The irony of celebrities is that they often have very fragile egos. In many cases, something in them drove them to want to be famous. Imagine being publicly scrutinized by thousands of people each day. However much the world opens up to celebrities, a part of it also closes. There is a loss of privacy. And because they live in a world of adulation, celebrities struggle every day balancing their private and public personas. They often fret over the fact that their public persona becomes indistinguishable from their private personality. They feel misunderstood and underappreciated for who they really are. To assure them that you're interested in them for themselves rather than what the public perceives them to be, stay away from their fame and focus instead on their interests. You can certainly let them know that you respect their work, but don't dwell. Take them away from what they are normally barraged with. Unfortunately, sometimes we make inappropriate exceptions when talking to exceptional people. You simply have to watch and listen with your heart as well as with your eyes. Find out what their passions are. Not long ago,